You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, the discovery of angel particles, or matter that's its own antimatter.
Anytime you see quantization, always very exciting, right? This quantization is everything. Now we see half a step, even more exciting.
Investigating whether we need a conscious observer to drive the transition from quantum to classical reality.
And then we want to relate this to the question of objectivity. So it's known that if we all observe one phenomenon, more or less we can see that there is some objective truth, even though some people in the US provide alternative realities at the moment. But at the quantum level, it's not like that. So every time you make some observation, then you can get some different response.
And will future androids dream of quantum sheep? How to build the perfect quantum replicant?
There was a duck. They put it on the stage, and supposedly this mechanical duck, it could walk around, could quack, it could eat, and they actually had live performances where they had a shit as well.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster.
Welcome back to the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. Today's edition tackles how we came to exist from matter rather than antimatter, whether we need the presence of consciousness for reality to emerge, and how to build an artificial consciousness.
So, just the small questions this time, eh?
Ah, that's right. But before we get to all that, we should congratulate physicists working on the LIGO experiment in the United States and the Virgo experiment in Italy, who in October announced that they had spotted more gravitational waves, ripples in the fabric of space-time. You'll remember that LIGO hit the news previously after the experiment, which was 50 years in the making, made the first ever detection of gravitational waves generated by the collisions of two black holes.
This time round, the two labs have combined to pick out waves generated by the collision of two neutron stars 130 million light years away. The crashing stars spewed out gold in the process and other precious metals such as uranium and platinum. This helps solve a mystery of how and where these heavy elements are forged in the universe.
It's been a great month for LIGO, since Rainer Weiss, Barry Barish, and Kip Thorne were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics in October. So congratulations for another truly amazing accomplishment, this time with the Virgo team as well.
We've obviously talked a lot about LIGO on this podcast in the past, and you can find out more in our May 2016 edition, in which Brendan interviewed LIGO team member Alessandro Buonanno, and in the December 2016 edition, in which physicist Ian Durham picked LIGO's announcement of their discovery of black hole collisions as a highlight of the year. You can listen to both of those on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. And I'm pretty sure we'll have more to say about the neutron star collision on 2017's end of year podcast rundown too, in December.
But now we're turning to the matter of antimatter, and to an experimental discovery that's another highlight of this year. In July, a team of physicists at Stanford University found evidence of particles that are their own antiparticles.
In the 1920s, British physicist Paul Dirac realized that particles, like electrons for example, have antimatter counterparts with the same mass, but with other properties, such as their charge, reversed. So, the negatively charged electron has a positively charged antiparticle called the positron.
And in the 1930s, Italian physicist Ettore Majorana realized that some particles belonging to the same family as electrons, the fermion family, might be their own antiparticle. They are officially called Majorana fermions, but unofficially they have been dubbed angel particles in reference to the best-selling 2000 thriller Angels and Demons, by Scott Brown?
No, that guy, Dan Brown, the one who does
The
Da Vinci Code, that guy. Yeah.
Right, yeah. Angels and Demons by Dan Brown, in which a secret brotherhood plots to blow up the Vatican with a time bomb whose explosive power comes from matter, antimatter, This is a hard script.
It's not my fault. It's these people making these discoveries.
They are officially called Majorana fermions, but unofficially they have been dubbed angel particles in reference to the best-selling 2000 thriller Angels and Demons by Dan Brown, in which a secret brotherhood plots to blow up the Vatican with a time bomb whose explosive power comes from matter-antimatter annihilation.
Earlier, I caught up with Stanford team leader Kang L. Wang to find out how to make Majorana fermions in the lab, and how they might one day help engineers trying to build super-fast computers. But first, Wang began by describing how these angel particles could tell us more about our own cosmic origins.
You know, today we know we have matters and antimatters. So what we are, human being, or the real world, the so-called matters. But there should be a antimatter somewhere, which what happens to them.
So, right, yes, that's absolutely a huge question you're referring to there, you know, the mystery of why there's more matter than antimatter.
Right, and that was so interesting because related to what we are, the existence of us, that's from cosmology and particle theory point of view. So cosmologists just begin to think about, hey, maybe Big Bang somehow disturbed the balance of the particles and matters and antimatters and pushed towards what we know matters. And so it has implication of what we are. And so the particle physicists and cosmologists is very interested since then.
Kang L. Wang, a physicist at Stanford University, is describing one reason why physicists are so interested in antimatter, the particle twins to the normal matter that makes up humans and all we see around us in the everyday world. During the Big Bang, matter and antimatter are supposed to have been created in equal quantities. But if that was the case, these oppositely charged but otherwise largely identical particles would have recombined together, vanishing from existence. But that didn't happen. Instead, today, we see a world made from matter. So what happened to the antimatter? This foundational question is one of the reasons Wang is so excited about Majorana fermions, particles that are their own antiparticles. He and his colleagues at Stanford recently generated such Majorana fermions in the lab. But before describing exactly how they achieved this feat, he explains another motivation for his interest in these weird particles. They could serve as the building blocks of a quantum computer, a machine which could exploit quantum effects to zip through certain tasks and calculations that would take a conventional computer an astronomically long time to carry out.
Then suddenly they'll be interested in so-called quantum computing, and it can solve exponentially hard problem, meaning traditional computer, if you increase the complexity of the problem, the resources, that is number of transistors, whatever that is, increase exponentially.
One of the key materials for building quantum computers is a superconductor. Inside such a material, electrons pair up, forming Cooper pairs, allowing them to move quickly through the material without resistance. In 2000, physicists realized that this process might also play a role in creating Majorana fermions within the material.
So since 2000, a theorist also predict by putting the nanowires interface with superconductors. Now, because superconductors has this Cooper pairs, and they're interacting energies, what happened is that any interaction will make it this quantum space twice bigger. What does that mean? That means that electrons somehow split into two pairs, and they've shown that it's two pairs of Majorana fermion.
And this is why we call them quasi-particles, because they're existing inside the material.
Exactly. That's the solid-state version of Majorana fermion.
In recent years, experimenters have tried to create Majorana particles in the lab, and they have seen convincing glimpses, though they have not been able to prove so definitively to everyone's satisfaction. Wang and his team hope to generate these particles within a material without any shadow of a doubt.
The question, of course, they observed some signature, like a peak, but the community debated for a long time. thinking this can come from, say, for example, Condor effect, many-body interaction of the solids, so they've never been settled. So the debate continue, and our experiment is to avoid this all the confusion of the peaks here and there, right? Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure our measurement can be referred to a quantized number.
Features of particles are said to be quantized if they cannot change continuously, but only through discrete steps. In this case, the team was interested in conductance, a measure of how easily electric charges move through a material. If Majorana fermions are created, then this conductance shouldn't increase smoothly, but in jumps.
So we want to use a quantization to ascertain if indeed electron is split into two sets of Majorana fermions. That's how we set forth.
The Stanford experiment to generate Majorana fermions and their quantized conductance started with another exotic ingredient, a so-called topological insulator, that took around 10 years to grow in the lab. This is a specially designed material that is an insulator on the inside, so it doesn't conduct electricity through its interior. But electrons can move along its edges, conducting electricity along its surface. Wang explains how the team employed the topological insulator with a touch of magnetism sprinkled in their experiment.
Now, how to do that is a very intricate process, right? To grow this topological insulator is cumulative years of close to 10 years, right? In fact, the conception was conceived in 2003. This is what is so unique about what we're doing in the past 10 years. So what we did, you take a topological insulator, you dope with the magnetic material, so it becomes magnetic topological insulator in essence. And they will do the same thing. The electron will become moving on the edge only, and they are quantized, and they are also dissipationless. So now we have this edge conduction without dissipation, exactly what we're looking for, all conductance quantized.
Electrons can only travel along the edge of this magnetic topological insulator. The special material is then sandwiched together with a superconductor, which, as Wang explains, acts as the medium in which Majorana particles can be generated.
Because I mentioned you need to create Majorana fermions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And superconductor is like an ocean, right? If you drop something in the ocean, something split up. If you do not have an ocean, then just on land, nothing happens, right? You have to go to a different space. And the superconductor is the media to create a different space, which is called Majorana space for you.
And indeed, when the superconductor is sandwiched on top of the magnetic topological insulator, the team has all the ingredients in place to generate Majorana particles, at least in theory. The trouble comes when they try to detect them. The Majorana fermions tend to move around in pairs, but when the properties of a pair of Majorana fermions are measured together, they just look like the properties of an electron. So you cannot be sure that the Majorana particles are really there. The trick is to split the pair apart and measure the conductance signature of a single Majorana particle. Wang.
You may have Majorana fermion, but you detect two sets of them, then that becomes just like you measure electrons, so no difference, you cannot tell.
You were sort of saying in order to be able to detect it properly, you kind of want to split those to...
Exactly. You got it right there. You've got to split so that otherwise you detect electrons only. Now, how do I change the phase so that I can split my two sets of Majorana fermion up to one set, right?
Yes.
Right. So the way to do it is by adjust small magnetic field. Very weak magnetic field. Remember, too high the magnetic field destroy the superconductor. But you have a very small magnetic field, and you can show that if you adjust the small magnetic field, one can make a topological phase transition so that one can split two Majorana fermions into one. And by doing so, we can measure the conductance of the channel, of a single Majorana fermion conductance channel, which end up would be one half of electron conduction.
Oh, right. And so how excited were you when you found, you know, that this was working?
Anytime you see quantization, always very exciting, right? This quantization is everything. Now we see half a step, even more exciting.
And you sort of, you mentioned that, you know, one of the reasons this is kind of interesting to you was in terms of thinking about quantum computing. So are people thinking about using these Majorana fermions as qubits themselves?
As I mentioned before, in a different approach in past 25 years of 30 years of quantum computing work, the key problem or the critical challenge is the coherence of qubits, that's entangled qubits. That is the flipping error or phase error. So that's the reason prohibit people to go in many qubits. With the Majorana fermions, you could do a localized Majorana fermion state. Therefore, it should be topologically protected from this decoherency physical processes. This is the basis of so-called topological quantum computing. This will be very robust, so that people are very interested in that, besides cosmology and particle theories. And that's the reason, last 10 years, a tremendous amount of effort in solid state trying to work on that.
And then, you know, you mentioned also the cosmology, the particle physics side of trying to understand this puzzle about matter and antimatter and where all the antimatter has disappeared. And also there are huge experiments trying to create, you know, antimatter.
And Majorana fermion too, to identify too.
Yes, yes, yes. So now, you know, we've made it in the lab in this kind of quasi-particle form. Mm-hmm. What bearing does that have on questions of whether Majorana fermions can exist as, you know, elementary fundamental particles out there, you know, in the world, in the universe?
So I think this book inspired the other side of work to say, hey, I have now more confidence to look for, because before they were not so sure, because after all, Majorana proposed it, and therefore it's a hypothesis only, right?
Yeah.
So I think that will be the impetus of this work toward other areas.
And if you can create these in quasi-particle form in the lab, is there some way to control them and to do experiments with them to understand more about their fundamental properties, perhaps, to see...
Excellent, excellent question. That lies ahead of us. So we have planned to say, okay, can we make this Majorana fermion? Can we then interact with another Majorana fermion, which the technical terms called braiding? Braiding is like, you know, weaving sweater. You can do by weaving, right? And this is similar. The technical term is called braiding. So that by braiding this Majorana fermion, be a major step forward to understand this set of Majorana fermions. So a lot of work lies ahead for us.
Thank you to Kang L. Wang for chatting with Zia. You'll find links to more information about the Stanford team's experiment on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
It's also worth going back and listening to our rundown of the top physics stories of 2012 in the December edition of that year, where we picked out and discussed an earlier glimpse of Majorana particles in the lab.
Now, one idea touched on in that segment was that Majorana particles could help physicists trying to exploit delicate quantum features of particles to build super-fast quantum computers. But, as mentioned, those fragile features are easily disrupted in the lab.
One of the biggest mysteries in physics is what exactly causes the disruption of the quantum realm. Different rules apply at the microscopic quantum level. Small particles can be in two places at the same time, for instance.
But in the everyday classical world, that's not the case. You can't be in two places at the same time, no matter how much you may want to be. What causes this quantum to classical transition? In the early days of quantum physics, its founders talked about how quantum properties collapse when a system is observed. But does that mean that you literally need a conscious observer to examine a system and disrupt it? Or could an artificial intelligence or interactions with inanimate objects in the environment be equally as destructive to quantum properties?
That's a question that quantum physicist Gerardo Adesso of Nottingham University in the UK is investigating. He and his colleagues are trying to find out if there is a form of Darwinian natural selection at work in the microrealm, giving rise to the classical world around us, as he explained to reporter Colin Stewart.
The role of the observer has a long history in the story of quantum physics. Perhaps its most famous incarnation is in the legendary thought experiment of Schrödinger's cat, a feline trapped in a box that's both dead and alive until a measurement is made. But does it matter if the object making that measurement is conscious, such as a human or future artificial intelligence, or will the outcome be the same for an unconscious machine? A team of physicists based at the universities of Nottingham and Strathclyde in the UK will be using a grant from FQXI to try to find out. I spoke with principal investigator Gerardo Adesso, but before we got into the subject of conscious observers, I asked him what he normally works on.
Okay, so my research fits into, let's say, quantum information theory. But more specifically, I'm interested in understanding the correlations between elementary constituents of matter. So what distinguishes the behavior of particles in the microscopic world from ordinary objects in the classical microscopic world? Where is the border between quantum and classical physics?
Can you tell us more about that border?
Yes, so typically at small scales, quantum mechanics effects are very relevant. In the conventional macroscopic scales, we don't see many of these quantum effects. Part of my research is into actually locating where the border is, because you can see some effects which also persist at large temperature, at large scales, at in complex systems. And whenever you have particular manifestations of quantumness, so that, I don't know, superposition or entanglement or other quantum correlations, then you can exploit them for information processing in ways which are better than if you don't use these extra resources.
Can you just remind us what you mean by entanglement?
Okay, entanglement is synonymous of inseparability. So you have a system divided in two parts, and these two parts are correlated in such a way that if you think of the system as a whole, you have complete information about its state. But if you look at each of the parts independently, then you have some ignorance. So you cannot reconstruct the full state of the system only by looking at one of its parts. And the information you're missing is in the correlations between the two. And of course, you can have correlations also in classical probability. But entanglement is a form of correlations that you cannot create by so-called local operations and classical communication. So suppose we are now on the phone. You have a coin, and I have a coin, and then we have a third coin, and we decide, okay, I flip the third coin, and if I get heads, I put my coin on heads, and you put your coin on heads. If I get tails, I put my coin on tails, and you put your coin on tails. This is creating a classical correlation. Communicating on the phone, and then based on outcome of this communication, so I tell you whether heads or tails, then we do a local operation on our own device. Entanglement can never be created in this way. So it requires our two coins to come together and they have to interact somehow. So typically you might even think of, I don't know, one atom which splits into two parts, and then these two parts travel far away, but they originate from the same source. This kind of correlation is different from what we can create by local operations and classical communication.
And making a measurement is important in distinguishing between quantum and classical behavior?
It can be a measurement device. This is one of the most complicated problems because it's still not solved. So at some point, one of the founding fathers and contributor to many areas of mathematics and physics is John von Neumann. He was trying to devise this ideal experiment where you have a system and then you have to measure something. Okay, suppose, I don't know, you have a photon and you want to observe its polarization. So to do so, you have to come up with another system. The second system has to interact with the object you're observing. And then you need to make a readout on the second system, this apparatus. But this second system can be, in principle, another photon. Okay, so it's still a quantum mechanical object. And then to make the readout, again, you have to come up with another system and then couple with the previous apparatus and so on. And then he was wondering at which point this chain can be broken. And so effectively you get some classical some number out of this, no? Because so far we only have quantum states and systems which keep interacting with each other. And he concluded that if you treat every object in this chain fully as a quantum mechanical device, then you can never break this. Okay, so you can never fully collapse the quantum state of each of these chain of observing and observer devices. And at some point, the scale of the problem will become so big that approximately you will have reached some kind of classical transition. But it was impossible to draw this line with certainty. And so one way to try to circumvent this problem is to assume that either you could say, okay, my apparatus is macroscopic, it's classical, and I don't treat it quantum mechanically, and then fine. Immediately you say you can observe collapse of the quantum state, which is being observed by big apparatus. But on the other hand, you can still have this interaction between different compatibly sized measurement devices, and then you assume that they are immersed into an environment. This environment contains a large number of degrees of freedom whose interaction is something we can't control. And so this is what causes the phenomenon of so-called decoherence. When you have this, then effectively this gives some explanation to the fact that the information being observed effectively becomes classical.
Part of your research will look into the idea of quantum Darwinism, the idea that some quantum states undergo a process similar to natural selection in the animal world. Can you tell us more?
So it says that if you have many observers which are observing the same phenomenon, only the classical part of the information can correlate with each of the observers, while the quantum part of the information cannot be shared. Okay, and so this is one of the basis of our proposal, because we want to quantify this when the observed system is of large dimension, still using the quantum mechanical rules.
And you want to see if a thinking observer, whether that be human or some future artificial intelligence, makes a difference to what's observed?
Here we are trying to approach the subject of consciousness and whether, first of all, we can describe it within the conventional rules of quantum mechanics. Because the idea is that you need to have an observer, and this observer has to have a certain awareness of itself and of the environment around it. So by forming this awareness, then it will establish correlations between its internal parts, say with its memory, and also with other entities with which it interacts. And by studying the nature of correlations, we want to see whether there is some trade-off between the more these correlations are quantum and the more this system develops a consciousness. Okay, that's the rough idea. And then we want to relate this to the question of objectivity. So it's known that more or less we can agree on some facts. If we all observe one phenomenon, more or less we can see that there is some objective truth, even though some people in the US provide alternative realities at the moment. But at the quantum level, it's not like that. So every time you make some observation, then you can get some different response. So, and also an observation of a system will change the state of the thing you're observing. So at some point, there will be some transition from this situation, quantum mechanics, where the observer disturbs what is being observed, and the classical reality, which is objective and all the observers agree on it.
How difficult a task is that likely to be?
We don't know. We want to start by exploring some toy models and effectively scale up their complexity to see. We will never be able to reproduce the human brain, but we want to start with something simple and see if at some point there is an onset of, let's say, self-awareness. But we have to find a way to quantify it. So part of the project is to actually recognize what are signatures of consciousness and then give it a quantitative framework. But we have not done this yet.
And what do you think you might find?
We leave it open. We even say that it may even, let's say, display some fundamental inconsistency within the quantum description. Because sometimes we, as I said, quantum mechanics is linear, while it might be that the self-interaction that is required for consciousness would contradict the basic linearity of quantum mechanics. So we even leave this possibility open. I don't know if that would be a big deal. I don't think we will get to that point with certainty. But to be honest, this is not my main. Normally, I research things which are a bit less controversial. But here we teamed up with two other colleagues, and we got a bit drifted apart in conceiving this project. I'm really looking forward to doing this more concretely. So we are hiring a postdoc. He's starting in March, and he has some ideas how to model this. He has already spoken with people also in neuroscience from the Center for Consciousness at Sussex University, where he is now. So we're very looking forward to get more concrete tests of the ideas of the project.
That was Gerardo Adesso speaking with reporter Colin Stewart. You can read more about Adesso's project in an article written by Colin on the website www.fqxi.org/community.
Now, Adesso was musing in the abstract about whether an artificial intelligence could have the same effect on reality as a biologically evolved consciousness. But how would you go about actually building a Blade Runner-style replicant? Quantum physicist Jane Thompson of the Center for Quantum Technologies in Singapore and her colleagues have been thinking about whether sprinkling in some quantum ingredients could make an AI's memory more efficient, as she explained over a slightly challenging Skype line to reporter Colin Stewart.
We humans have a long history of trying to create artificial copies of living things. Physicist Jane Thompson is not only fascinated by our fixation with these automaton, but she believes studying how to make optimum copies might teach us something fundamental about the quantum nature of reality. She started our conversation by giving me a potted history of some of our more colourful attempts at mimicry.
It turns out that it's quite a long history, and the earliest written records were purportedly mechanical birds, which supposedly could fly up to about 200 metres. And then there was a long history of people trying to design automaton with Leonardo da Vinci, who actually worked on robotic knights. And the idea was that he wanted a suit of armor to actually mimic a human being, or to mimic some of the gestures and some of the natural behavioral aspects of humans, in the way that he wanted it to actually be able to sit down, to engage with people, and to be able to lift its visor to salute people. And he actually had the whole thing working by pulleys and weights. The knight, or the mechanical armor, actually performed all of these tasks autonomously by itself. And then more recently, as things got a lot more complex and a lot more sophisticated, and I think about the 17th century, there was a duck. They put it on the stage, and supposedly this mechanical duck, it could walk around, could quack, it could eat, and they actually had live performances where they had a shit as well. So this was a big phenomenon in France. A lot of people actually were there watching this duck, a mechanical duck, imitate a real-life system. But there's a little bit of speculation that in reality the duck couldn't go to the toilet, and that what happened was it was some stage trickery where they sort of put the poo on the stage.
You said the Turing test is important in distinguishing whether something is conscious. Can you remind us of Turing's ideas?
If we, as a society, develop better and better artificial intelligence, at what stage do we call the thing conscious and maybe need to afford it rights as being a sentient being in some ways? And what he said was that, well, you should call it conscious when you talk to it and you ask any series of questions. You can't distinguish it from a real human being. So the moment in which there is no question, no test that you can do, such that you can decide whether it was a collection of computer parts and hardware or whether it was actually a conscious sentient being, is the point at which you should turn around and say, well, I accept that this is a conscious entity.
How does the ability to remember play a role in this?
If you think about what you have to do this, right? Well, obviously, we have our future behavior depends on our past experiences, usually. Like, we show some notion of continuity, in the sense that how we behave tomorrow depends in some ways on what's happened to us today. What's happening is that we're going through life experiencing things, experiencing sequences of events, and we're storing some information about those in our memory. And then hopefully in the future, when things happen again, we respond differently depending on our past experiences and depending on our memories. Hopefully we've learned from our past memories, we've adapted our behavior, at least supposedly if we're intelligent, we have. So perfectly mimic these systems, you have to store some information about their past experiences in a memory, in a device somewhere, because the real-life system itself updates its behavior conditioned on what's happened to it in the past. So one part of the task is isolating out what pieces of information about the past you need to store, what pieces are relevant to the system's future behavior, and also then encoding them as efficiently as possible into the memory of the device, such that it can replicate the system's future responses. And what we found was that when you're quantum, or when the device is quantum, the amount of information about the past it needs to store, and the amount of past memories it has to keep track of, and how efficiently and how small a hard drive it can encode this information into, you can get this a lot smaller. So you can store a lot less information, use a much smaller hard drive, if you're willing for the system to have a quantum mechanical memory. And there's improvements over the best possible classical devices. So we can actually isolate out the minimum amount of information any classical device must store. And then we can beat it systematically, as long as we just allow the memory of the device to be quantum.
Why is a quantum memory more efficient than a classical one?
It's to do with the structure of quantum mechanics. And a little bit of it, and particularly in the case of these mimicking live systems, it has a little bit to do with the lack of a definite reality in quantum systems. So classical systems turn out to store how they're going to react to every single possible future stimuli. In some ways, they store a deterministic strategy. But quantum systems don't always have a deterministic answer, a pre-described answer to every question you can ask them. They lack a realistic description. Instead, when you go and ask the system a question, you as the observer create a context. And the act of observation, the act of making that measurement and asking that question, it creates the outcome because the system wasn't definitively storing every single answer to every possible question you could ask it beforehand.
What was your motivation for working in this area? Is there a practical or theoretical payoff for understanding this area better?
When we approached it, originally at some levels it's an engineering task. Information and information storage and processing is very important in our society. As a matter of fact, I think there are some figures which suggest that the amount of energy and money we spend storing data is approximately equivalent to the cost of the airline industry. So we spend a lot of money storing and maintaining information. And increasingly, this is we have very complex systems which we wish to understand, and systems which have a large amount of data, perhaps footprints on the internet or something like this. We wish to be able to actually distill what's relevant out of this information and use it to make a prediction about what's going to happen in the future, or make a simulation of the future of that system. This is an immensely costly task as the systems get more and more complex. And in part, we were interested in it from an engineering perspective of, can a quantum device or a quantum computer, can it store less information and more easily isolate out what was the relevant pieces of information, such that it can run a simulation of what might happen in the future of the system on a much, much smaller hard drive? So it was originally in some ways an engineering question. But there is always a second motivation, which is fundamentally being curious about the nature of reality and the nature of the way information behaves in our reality. So on this level, can systems develop a preference for processing information using quantum degrees of freedom? Does it give an advantage if you were to actually store and process information in these degrees of freedom? Because it's fundamentally, there is a connection between the amount of information you store and the amount of inefficiency or heat dissipation which occurs during the process of generating the future behavior. And the less information you store, if you're quantum, you can reduce the amount of information you have to store, then you can be more efficient in the sense that you use less energy and you dissipate less heat. So is there a fundamental imperative which would make it more efficient to be quantum? And also, what makes a quantum system fundamentally different from a classical one? Does it actually fundamentally process information differently? Does it encode relevant information about the past differently to one which is purely classical? So what's the signature of something being quantum?
Thank you to Jane Thompson for speaking with reporter Colin Stewart there.
She may have sounded a little like an AI herself, but we assure you that's only because of the bad Skype connection. You can read more about her research in an article that Thompson wrote for us, which we are linking to on the website at www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
And while this isn't really physics related, since we've been talking about non-conventional beings and Nobel Prizes, congratulations too to one of my favourite authors, Kazuo Ishiguro, who wrote, among other books, Never Let Me Go, a literary science fiction book exploring the concept of what it means to be human. He was awarded this year's Nobel Prize in Literature.
That brings us to the end of the podcast. As always, you can contact us by email at podcast@fqxi.org and on Twitter at FQXI.
Thank you again to Kang L. Wang, Gerardo Adesso, Colin Stewart, and Jane Thompson.
She's been Zia Morali.
And he's been Brendan Foster. I'm off to catch an angel particle.
And I'm off to dream about quantum sheep.